Hallelujah. You know, we're kind of rolling along here, and we're getting towards the last four or five chapters in the book of Acts, so won't be too long, maybe another 30 weeks or so. It won't be that long at all. You know, these narrative sections, they kind of move along pretty good, so we'll be starting a new series in the future, and I'm not quite sure where we're going. So, you got any thoughts, ideas? I'll be willing to pray about them. Maccabees. Now, there's some interesting things in Maccabees. Goes right along with Josephus, War of the Jews, and. Well, we probably won't be dealing with Maccabees, but if there is, I'm open to pray about what you got, a book of the Bible maybe, or some aspect of Bible studies. I'm open to suggestions. I'm willing to pray about it anyway. All right, let's make our way to Acts chapter 23. We left off with Paul speaking to the Jewish Sanhedrin. Some kind of trial going on. I don't know if you call it a kangaroo trial or whatever, but in chapter 23 and verse 6, he kind of threw the whole thing into turmoil when Acts 23:6, when Paul perceived that one part was Sadducees, the other part Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Men and brethren, I'm a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, and it's of the hope and resurrection of the dead I am called into question." Because, you know, you remember, Sadducees, they don't believe in a resurrection, they don't believe in afterlife, they don't believe in angels, they don't believe in demons. They actually don't believe in the Old Testament, except for the first five books of the Bible. But other than that, they reject all the writings of history and the prophets and so on. So all the poetry books, they reject all of that. So, verse 7, when he had said that, there arose a dissension. This is a big dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the multitude was divided. For the Sadducees say there's no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. And there arose a great cry, and the scribes that were of the Pharisees' part arose and strove. Now, they're just about resorting to the fist fights here. And they saying, "We find no evil in this man." Imagine that. These are the people trying to prosecute him. Now they say, "There's nothing wrong with this man. We find no evil in this man. But if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God." And when there arose a great dissension, now it's really getting out of hand. The chief captain, fearing lest Paul should have been pulled in pieces of them, literally pulled limbs off of him. This is what he's concerned, that they're going to tear Paul apart. One's pulling him this way, one's pulling him that way. He's in the middle of a mob. He commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and to bring him into the castle Antonia. They brought him into the Antonia fortress. So he had to rescue him by force. So Paul finds himself back in the castle, back in the fortress Antonia. Maybe his visit to Jerusalem hadn't worked out the way he had hoped, but it worked out the way he was prepared for, because remember, he was warned several times, you're not going to find a great welcome in Jerusalem. He actually was told by the prophet Agabus, they're going to bind you, they're going to arrest you, and don't expect a hero's welcome when you get to Jerusalem. In verse 11, the Lord appeared to him. Verse 11, the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for just as you've testified of me in Jerusalem, you must also bear witness of me in Rome. So this would be good news. It meant he's getting out of Jerusalem alive, which at times, you know, seemed a little doubtful, and that his heart was to get to Rome. He just didn't expect to get there this way, under guard, under guard by soldiers. So then we come to an evil plot. Verse 12, Acts 23:12, and when it was day, certain of the Jews banded together, and they bound themselves under a curse. King James says under a curse. If you have a different translation, it might say under an oath. But what this oath is they anathematized themselves. So, you know, anathema means a curse upon you, and you know, you're cut off from God. Let them be anathema, cursed by God. So they claim, they swear an oath, an anathema upon themselves if they fail to kill the Apostle Paul. So verse 12, they bound themselves under a curse, saying they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. This is a great conspiracy. And verse 13 says, there were more than 40 which made this conspiracy. It's a great conspiracy. You get 40 people, well, actually over 40, so we don't know, 41, 49, but over 40 who take this oath, swearing this anathema curse upon themselves if they fail to kill Paul. We're not going to eat, we're not going to drink until he's dead. That's a pretty serious oath. It's about as serious as you can get. So, you know, I think Paul really needed the comfort of the night before when the Lord came and encouraged him. But they were determined they were going to get rid of Paul, the troublemaker, one way or another. They considered him a blasphemer. They considered him a heretic, that he was a destroyer of their religion. And by any means and all means, they would kill him. And if that's not bad enough, in the next verse, verse 14, they bring the elders, all the chief priests, which would include the high priest, they bring them into the great conspiracy. So it's bad enough there's over 40 of them, but verse 14, they came to the chief priests and the elders, and they said, we have bound ourselves under a great curse. They certainly did. That we will eat nothing until we have slain Paul. And now we want you to be a part of this great conspiracy. So here's the part you will play. Verse 15. Now therefore, you with the council signify to the chief captain that he bring him down unto you tomorrow. Bring Paul down again, as though you would inquire something more perfectly concerning him. And we, as soon as he comes near, are ready to kill him. So this is quite a conspiracy. They hatched a plan to assassinate Paul, the apostle. The chief priests, the elders, already co-conspirators. I mean, it's good for a country to have such godly leaders that they would conspire to murder someone, assassinate him under a pretense. Just convince your job. Now, he's actually addressing the high priest here and the chief priest. Your job, convince the captain, the chief captain, over the whole garrison, convince him that y'all have a matter you want to discuss with Paul, some questions you want to clear up, just ask him politely. Bring Paul down to us. We'll meet in the same place we met before. You know, we'll just meet right there and let us ask him those questions. It seems reasonable enough. And the plan is, once he leaves the safety of the fortress and gets down those steps, we will spring out and we will stab him to death, and then we'll just vanish. Quite a plan. So the problem with conspiracies, because this is all a great conspiracy, problem with conspiracies is that, well, it has too many moving parts. You know, if you ever read the book by J. Warner Wallace, A Cold Case Christianity, he talks about conspiracy theories in there as a detective. And he says, we've seen a lot of conspiracies, you know, people plotting something, and then they, two or three of them will conspire together that they're going to tell this particular story. He said, but when you separate them and you grill them, their stories always break down. Somebody's always going to give it up. Somebody's always going to fold, because, you know, people have a habit. They talk. And a conspiracy to hold, for a conspiracy to hold together, especially over any length of time, you can't have anybody telling. You can't have anybody talking. And the bigger the crowd that knows, the quicker it's going to unravel. So far, they've got over 40 conspirators. These are the assassins, however many. Now, you know, people also have families, and they have friends, and they do this. They tell, but don't tell nobody. But this is what we plan to do. Just shh, we'll see. So you know what happens. And then they bring in the council. That's 71 people counting the high priest. They got families. This conspiracy has really grown. It's impossible to keep that cat in the bag. Gordon, go ahead. You want to get a microphone? Let's get him a microphone. Go ahead.
The council is made up of Sadducees and Pharisees.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's not a good.
That's not a good combination, but that's the way it always was. And it was dominated by the Sadducees, the council.
But yeah, with the decision that happened before between the two groups,
that's right.
Somebody's going to say something.
Oh, yeah. They got to keep, that's a lot of people trying to keep a secret that nobody can tell. This is the same reason why all the great conspiracies that you hear about, it's why they can't possibly be true. Because somebody would have let the cat out the bag. You know, one great conspiracy that's been around since 1969, that is that the moon landing never happened. That never happened. That was all staged in a studio, big Hollywood production, staged in a studio, and they acted like they walking around on the moon. You know, it's amazing what you can do in a studio. They can make it look real. But it's all a conspiracy. Nobody went to the moon. That never happened. And not only that, but Artemis II, I think they called the one that just came back, that never happened either. That didn't happen. It was staged on a studio. It was a big production. They made it look real. But those astronauts were actors. And all of that was a great big pretense. It's all fake. A government conspiracy. So wait, let's think about this for a second. How many people would have to be in on this conspiracy? I want you to think about it. It would take not only tens of thousands of people, but probably 100,000 or more, all keeping a lie since 1969. Dave, go ahead.
And I would have to be in on it too, because I was flying across the Atlantic, looked out the window, and oh, look at that. The Earth is curved.
Oh,
oh yeah. And also, something else about that. Never mind.
I got to thinking about this great conspiracy, and I started, okay, listen to this. There would be perhaps 100,000 people involved in this great secret, to keep this secret. NASA engineers, mission controllers, technicians, private aerospace contractors, controllers, designers, builders, support staff, launch people, recovery people. And then that's not counting the studio that, you know, all of those people. You ever watch the credits for a movie at the end of the movie? It's as long as the movie sometimes. That's how many people are involved in making a production. So all of them are involved, and their families, and all the thousands and thousands and tens of thousands and their family. If you think 100,000 people can keep a secret, you do not know human nature. Because people talk. They talk. You know somebody would have let that cat out the bag by now. So whenever I hear things like that, I just have to shake my head. You know, you have to ignore reality to believe that. All like Brother Dave was saying, you know, the flat earthers. That's another thing that's... You know, more and more Christians are believing in a flat earth. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody about, you know, they believe the earth is flat. And I said, well, okay, how do we put satellites in orbit to get our satellite TV? And they said, no, there's no satellites out there. It's just very, very, very high, very thin radio towers that are just sending out the signals. You can look up with a pair of binoculars and see a satellite going past. No, your eyes are deceiving.
Yeah. I was looking at some of their arguments not long ago, and they will say, if you tell them, well, you know, the earth is a circle. They will say it's a circle, but it's not round. Because a nickel is a circle, but it's flat. A quarter is a circle, but it's flat, but it's not round. And I'm shocked at how many people jump in on things like this, and they ready to believe the earth is flat. Dave?
I'm not a real super adventurous person, but if the earth is flat, they'll tell you there's a ring of ice around the edge, okay?
That's right.
All right. We've got jets that can go shoot, shoot, shoot. I would pay thousands of dollars to get on a plane to go to the end, dive down and come back the other side. But why didn't somebody do that if it's really flat?
If the earth was flat, that's another great conspiracy that so many people are keeping a secret. It would be impossible to circle the earth, to head east and come out on the west coast. If you left New York, come out in California, you can't do that on a flat earth. But people do it all the time. So, you know, the latest conspiracy is the MedBed conspiracy. The MedBed. It is a bed. It's more like a pod that somehow the super ultra rich, the multi-billionaires and the super elite and big pharma, they have this technology where a person can get in a bed. And some of them believe it's alien technology, that it was gifted to us from aliens. But you can get in this bed and be healed of any disease, any ailment, grows limbs, cures Alzheimer's, any cancers. It disappears in minutes. In minutes, it disappears. But, they're not going to let the public know about it. It's a big secret because Big Pharma makes too much money peddling medicines, you know, for all these diseases, and they'd lose billions if they let people in on the secret of the magic bed that heals everything and everybody. Well, conspiracies don't hold up. But, you know, people love them. People love them. And it seems like people are gullible. They love their conspiracies. Anyway, I don't know why. We're in chapter 23 and verse 12. Verse 12. So what happens to conspiracies? Somebody talks. The cat gets out the bag. All these people involved in the conspiracy. We get to verse 16. And when Paul's sister's son heard of their lying in wait, we didn't even know Paul had a sister or a nephew until now. This is the first we hear of it in the Bible. Paul, obviously, Paul had a sister, and obviously he had a nephew. And maybe the nephew, maybe they lived in Jerusalem. Maybe they lived. Just maybe this is where they lived, or but anyway, he overheard this plot. He overheard it. When he heard, he went into the Antonia fortress, and he told Paul. And then Paul called one of the centurions unto him. Centurion is an important officer. He rules 100 people, 100 soldiers. He said, "Bring this young man to the chief captain, because he has a certain thing to tell him. It's, you know, obviously very important." So he took him and brought him to the chief captain and said, "Paul the prisoner," that's his new name, "Paul the prisoner called me unto him and prayed me to bring this young man unto thee, who has something to say unto thee." And the chief captain took him by the hand and went with him aside privately, probably brought him into a room, and he said, "Okay, what is it you've got to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to desire of you, to request of you that you would bring Paul down tomorrow into the council, as though they would inquire something of him more perfectly." They just want to ask him a few questions. They're going to come and ask you to allow Paul to come down. And when he does, he says, verse 21, "But do not thou yield unto them. Do not allow this, for there lie in wait for him of them more than 40 men, which have bound themselves with an oath that they will neither eat nor drink until they have killed him. And now are they ready." They're ready, they're poised. They're looking for that promise from you. I can imagine the chief captain has to be thinking, well, this is pretty brazen. They want to assassinate Paul, who is in our custody. And I don't want to have to account for the death of a Roman citizen in my custody who has not been charged with any crime, and yet he was killed under my watch. That wouldn't be good for him. And the chief captain didn't get into that position by being dumb. So he took heed, because he believed what this young man said. And he didn't waste any time. The very next verse says, in verse 22, "So the chief captain, this is the Kyriarchos, or Kyriarchos, that's what the word is, the chief captain. It's from Kilio, which means a thousand, and Arche, which means to be first or to be ruler. So this is the guy who rules the whole garrison. The garrison held 1,000 soldiers. He's the chief guy. The buck falls on him. Something happens to Paul, he is the one who has to answer to his superiors. So he's got 1,000 men at his disposal. This is what he said. He told the young man, "You go and keep your mouth shut. do not tell anybody that you've said this to me. And then verse 23, he called unto him two centurions. Now, what does a centurion rule over? 100 men. So he called two of them. What does that mean? 200 soldiers. He called 200 soldiers and he said, make ready 200 soldiers to go to Caesarea and then bring 70 horsemen, that's the cavalry, and spearmen, this is your light infantry, the spearmen, 200 at the third hour of the night. That's 9 p.m., 470 soldiers to guard one man. 470, that's half his garrison. That's the garrison's 1,000 men. He's got 470 to guard one man. He took this threat very seriously. Was it? What's that? It would have been his life. That's generally what happened. If you let a prisoner escape, they execute you, no matter who you are. And especially you let a Roman soldier, a Roman citizen be killed under your watch, a man uncondemned of any crime, they probably wouldn't even try him. They'd probably just kill him. So he wasn't going to take that chance. You got 200 foot soldiers. This would be the heavy armed, I mean, full battle array, shields, helmets. I mean, these guys, these are the warriors. 200 of those. You got 200 spearmen. That's your light infantry. And then you've got 70 cavalry. That's quite an entourage. He's got quite an escort taking him to Caesarea. And they said, and the captain says, you leave at 9 p.m. tonight. Which they did. 470 soldiers accompanying one prisoner. Verse 24 says, provide them beasts that they may set Paul on and bring him safe unto Felix the governor. Felix is the governor of all Judea. He was appointed by Claudius, the emperor. And his seat of authority was Caesarea. So that's where he was. You bring Paul there to Caesarea. And let Felix deal with this. This is getting a little out of hand. And then he wrote a letter in verse 25. After this manner, Claudius Lysias, that's the chief captain, unto the most excellent governor Felix sendeth greeting. This man was taken of the Jews and should have been killed of them. And then I came with an army and rescued him, having understood that he was a Roman. And when I would have known the cause wherefore they accused him, I brought him forth into their council, whom I perceived to be accused of questions of their law. But to have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or of bonds. Questions of Jewish law, you know, this would be Jewish rites, true Jewish rituals. The big deal was, he says, he's accused of violating some Jewish law, some Jewish tradition, something like that. But he's done nothing to deserve being executed. So, verse 30, when I was told how that the Jews laid wait for the man, I sent straightway to thee and gave commandment to his accusers also to say before thee what they had against him. Farewell. So Paul gets shipped off in the middle of the night. The next day they'll find out that Paul's not there. They'll be irate, and the chief captain will tell them, look, he's in front of the governor in Caesarea. Now you got to go there and bring your charges to him. So I guess it's a pretty smart move, really. So verse 31, then the soldiers did as was commanded them. They took Paul and they brought him by night to Antipatris. This is about halfway between Caesarea and Jerusalem. So an all night march got them to Antipatris, where they would spend the night. Dave?
Is there any historical record about what happened to those 40 people that said we won't even eat?
Here's the thing about the Jewish religion. At this time, if you could pay a priest, he could absolve you of your marriage. He could absolve you of your oath. And all you had to do was pay. Kind of like today, you know? It's as though it never happened. If you can pay, they'll absolve a marriage, they'll absolve your oath. Yeah, so it was really, as solemn as it sounds, didn't have any teeth in it, you know. It was a solemn oath, though. We swear before Almighty God. Couldn't do it. It's $10. Okay, you absolve. So they spend the night in Antipatris. Now I got to find my place. Okay, that's verse 31. And then on the morning, they left the horsemen to go with him, and the rest returned to the castle. So the 400 that were on foot went back. They went back to Jerusalem. And I'm sure they did that for two reasons. One, they had marched all night long. They had gotten Paul safely out of the danger zone. So, you know, they went through that hill country, getting all the way to Antipatris. So that's where the greatest danger lurked, of assassins or marauders springing upon him. They considered he's out of danger now. Now the horsemen can take him the rest of the way. These others will go back to Jerusalem, and I'm sure it'll be a quick march, because the Jews there are not going to be happy when they find out Paul's not there. So back to Jerusalem. You need your full group of troops there just to make sure these guys don't start any trouble. So, verse 33. So when they came to Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor, and they brought Paul also before him. This is the guy. This is the letter. This is what it's all about. When the governor read the letter, he asked of what province he was. What province are you under, Paul? And when he understood that he was of Cilicia, now Cilicia is where Tarsus was the capital of that particular province, he said, verse 35, I will hear you. That is, I will hear your case. I will let you speak. I will give you a fair hearing. He says, I will hear you. Said he, when your accusers are also come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. The judgment hall was the praetorium. It was a palace that Herod had built for himself. Pretty opulent. It had been quite a few years before that happened. And now they used it where many of the soldiers, especially officers, were housed. But they also had guard rooms there in the praetorium, where they could keep a prisoner or several prisoners if they wanted to. It wasn't like being thrown into a common prison. So it was way better than being in the common prison, but it was still pretty stark by our standards. He was under guard. Some say he was actually chained. He had to be chained to a guard the whole time. But he was allowed to have visitors. And in fact, Roman prisons, you know, they didn't feed the prisoners. You better have a friend who can bring you something to eat, because they did not provide food in Roman prisons. So it was was not easy. The prisoners didn't have much rights in those days, but at least he heard from the governor, Felix. He said, I will hear you. I will hear you. You know, he's a Roman citizen. He deserves to be heard. So I will hear you, but I'm going to send for your accusers. They're going to come. They're going to bring the charges against you, and then I will give you a chance to be heard. So Felix the governor. See, we got through chapter 23, and we're not going to quit there because the story gets even better. So, excuse me. So Felix the governor, this is quite a guy. Now, he's going to have to wait. Paul's going to have to wait in the praetorium. He's in the guard room before he can appear before the governor. His accusers have to come, and they'll level all their charges. So we get to chapter 24, and we see that after 5 days, Ananias the high priest descended with the elders. Here they come. Boy, they're going to level their accusations against Paul. And they look who they brought, Morris Bart. They came with a certain orator named Tertullus, who informed the governor against Paul. They brought a lawyer. In those days, you know, Roman law was extremely complex. It kind of like our own law, extremely complex. So they hired, the high priest and the elders hired a lawyer. Now, today we would call him a prosecuting attorney. In those days, you hired your own prosecutor, like if you were bringing charges against someone. So they hired him. Now, this guy would have been a skilled orator, skilled in the Roman law. He knew exactly what to say, and he knew exactly what not to say, because they needed Paul to be condemned. But what you don't say is just as important what you do say, because in this case, he doesn't want to say that Paul is in this jail all because of some discrepancy they have, you know, between the Pharisees and Sadducees. It's not a matter of a Jewish law. It's a matter of sedition. This man is a seditionist. Now, a seditionist, that's someone who stirs up riots, causes insurrection, and disturbs the peace, disturbs the sacred Pax Romana, the Roman peace. Look, Rome wanted peace in all of these provinces and outposts that it controlled. Peace at any price. Anybody causes an uprising, just kill them. Any problems, just kill them. Don't disturb the peace. They want quiet and calm in their realm. So they killed criminals. They killed insurrectionists. And they had a lot of insurrection in those days, especially from the Jews, because the Jews did not like the Romans, and the Romans did not much like the Jews. Now, Felix himself was not a good person, Felix the governor. In fact, all the historians say that he was hated by the Jews, because whenever there was even a minor insurrection among the Jews, he sent those soldiers down there in great force, and they just killed them all. They were unmerciful. And not the nicest guy around. He married a woman named Drusilla, who was a Jewess and actually a daughter or granddaughter of King Agrippa. And Tacitus, the Roman historian, said that he ruled with all the authority of a king, but all of the malice of a slave, and that he was a vulgar, evil, corrupt man, a corrupt politician. The Jews hated him. So here comes the lawyer, here comes the high priest. They're going to stand before Felix the governor. So then they call Paul, verse 2, in Acts 24 and verse 2. Paul is called, and Tertullus began to accuse him, because that's what these prosecuting lawyers do. They accuse him. But they start, he's wise, you know, he's been around. He knows what to do. So he starts with flattery. Verse 2, he says, "Oh, seeing by thee that we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness." All of this is hogwash, because Felix was neither noble nor gracious in any way. Like I said, he had crushed several insurrections, even if they were minor already. And it was under his reign, under Felix, that a group of Jewish assassins arose that were called the Sicarii. The Sicarii, S-I-C-A-R-I-I, Sicarii. You get a chance, you look those guys up. They were mighty, mighty dangerous people. They were Jews. They were a part of the Zealot revolt, but these guys were so extreme that even the Zealots kind of were afraid of them, to be associating with them. And they were called the Sicarii, because Sicarii means a dagger. So they were called the dagger men. And their MO, their modus operandi, was that they would blend into a crowd, you know, especially when they were having festivals and all the streets were crowded. They would blend into the crowd. They would just walk up to their target. Whether they'd kill Romans, they loved to kill Roman officers, but they'd kill any Roman. They would kill Jewish collaborators, those who collaborated with the Romans. They'd kill them. They'd just walk up, you know, casually to them, stab them a bunch of times, and then put their knife back in their cloak and then walk away with the crowd. And then they'd say, "Oh my goodness, what happened to him? Call the authorities." And they were very, very successful. They were terrorists. That's what they did. Extremely, extremely dangerous men. So actually, if you remember back in chapter 21, when Paul was first apprehended, they actually thought that's what he was, one of the Sicarii. In fact, I'm going to have you turn there. Back, keep your finger here. I'm coming right back, But chapter 21 and verse 38, you remember what was going on? Y'all with me? All right. So Paul was making a defense. He gets arrested. Verse 37, Paul was to be led into the castle. He said to the chief captain, "May I speak unto you?" He said, "You can speak Greek? Aren't you that Egyptian," now he was talking about like an Egyptian Jew, "which before these days made an uproar and led us out into the wilderness, 4,000 men that were murderers?" The word here, the 4,000 men, is Sicarios. This was dagger men, assassins. "Weren't you the head guy of all the assassins? I thought this is what this was all about." So they actually originally thought that Paul was one of these guys. You know how later on, this would be somewhere around 66 AD, y'all heard of Masada, the plateau out in the desert, that this plateau overlooked the Dead Sea, the Great Salt Sea. Herod built a fortress there. actually was like a palace and a place to escape in case. Back in those days, Herod was afraid of being attacked by Cleopatra and the Egyptians, you know. But anyway, he built this big fortress on top of a plateau, a high, steep plateau. He built a whole fortress up there. He had cisterns installed that could catch rain, and the rain that it could catch, they said in one rainfall, one good rainfall, it could catch enough water to supply his troops, all the troops he had stationed there, for months. So, and they built big storehouses. He built a palace on each side of the plateau. It was quite elaborate. We got to visit Masada. You go to Masada, Dave? Did you get to go? It's really an interesting place and has a lot of history. It's almost a religious shrine to the Jews because 66 AD, the Sicarii attacked that fortress. And not only did they attack it, they took it from the Romans and they killed everybody that was there. They killed the entire garrison that was stationed there. They seized all their weapons and they held that plateau because the only way up there was a narrow stone stairway that could not. It could be so easily defended that any attempt to get up there, it would be instant. You'd be killed. They could hold off thousands of soldiers, which they did. They held off thousands of soldiers for years in that garrison. After they took Masada and held it, then they went to the Antonia Fortress, the Sicarii. They went to the Antonia Fortress, where this chief guard was. Hopefully he wasn't there anymore. Killed all the people that were instantly available. The ones who stayed inside, they managed to starve them out. They finally surrendered. They said, look, we'll sign a treaty with you. We'll let you surrender. They put down their arms. They surrendered. They killed them all. That's just the way the Sicarii operated. Around 70 AD, in the fall of Jerusalem, the Sicarii were holding. It was Sicarii who held the Masada, who held it. And 960 Jews, the Sicarii men, their families, children, wives, were holding the fortress. The Romans realized we can't breach this fortress. The only way we can get there is we're going to build a road from the floor of the desert up to the plateau. And they started, I guess they must have brought in thousands and thousands of slaves, and they started piling up rocks, and it took them years, but they built a road to the fortress, all the way up from the desert floor. And when they invaded and broke down the walls of Masada, all of the Jews inside were dead because they chose to commit mass suicide rather than fall into the hands of the Romans. And so 960 died by their own hand. And there's a bunch of different accounts of that. Josephus is the one who talks most about the Sicarii. Yes, go ahead.
And to this day, anybody that's sworn into the Israeli military is brought to Masada, and they say, never again.
That's right. That is their cry. You know, like the war cry of the Spanish-American War, remember the Alamo? Well, the war cry of the Jewish soldiers is never again. Never again will we take our own lives. Never again. We will fight to the death. We will never, ever do that again. So, I've, you know, there's a lot of rewriting history these days. And I've read accounts where some people are now saying, and these are Jewish people for the most part. Others are historians saying, that never happened. That never happened. Of course, they say the Holocaust never happened. Of course, they say the moon landing never happened. And neither did Artemis circling. It's all fake. Everything's fake nowadays. Well, anyway, Paul is on trial for his life, and he knew it. When they brought this lawyer in, he knew this is going to be a problem. So here comes the lawyer. Now, we got a couple more minutes. Yes, I'm in Acts 24. I'm in Acts 24. So, you know, he's flattering noble Felix. And verse 4, he says, I don't want to be tedious. I don't want to take any more of your time. I pray you would hear us. Just give us a little grace. Just a few words. I got just a few words to say. Four charges he brings against Paul. We have found this man a pestilent fellow. Pestilent. Literally, this guy's a plague. He's a contagious disease. And let me tell you what his disease infects people with. Sedition, verse 5. He is a seditionist, an insurrectionist, a revolutionary, a rebel against Rome. This is a dangerous man. Quite all right. He is a very dangerous man who needs to be executed. He's always trying to undermine Rome's authority. And you know what a seditionist was? It's somebody who incited mobs and riots and trouble. And even though Paul did not incite mobs and riots and trouble, they followed him. They followed him. And boy, if they started bringing in people from Asia, you know, these Jews from Ephesus where they had the great riots, or they bring them in from Lystra where they stoned him, or Derbe, or Iconium, or any of the places they chased him out, they had riots and so forth, he would have been in trouble. Because every place he went, they had riots. Even though he was not a seditionist and he wasn't trying to undermine Rome, Paul's on trial for his life here, and he knows it. He's pestilent. He's a plague. He's a seditionist among the Jews throughout the world. Everywhere he goes, he causes riots. And he's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Now, this is what they were calling the Jesus followers. They called them the sect of the Nazarenes. And here's what he's saying in this accusation. The Nazarenes would be an illegal religion. He's actually saying he is not a Jew. He has branched off from the Jewish religion. Jewish religion is a legal religion in Rome. They allowed them to practice. You know, Rome didn't like other religions. They had a few religions that they allowed, and as long as you behaved yourself, didn't cause a problem, you were allowed to practice your religion. They gave you great freedom to practice your religion. But they didn't like new religions popping up. And that's what they're accusing Paul. He's starting a brand new religion. This is the sect of the Nazarenes. They're following a guy that y'all had to crucify not long ago. So this guy's pretty slick, you know, making all these charges. And then the fourth allegation, verse 6, he's also gone about to profane the temple. He was profaning the temple. That was the charge where, you know, he brought Gentiles into the temple, which it's punishable by death, which, of course, Paul did not do. And when we caught him, we took him, and we would have judged him according to our law. Now, it sounds like they arrested him very lawfully, orderly, and we're going to deal with him, you know, legally according to that, which is not what happened, but this is what he's telling Felix. And then listen to this. And then, verse 7, the chief captain Lysias, he pounced upon us and with great violence took him away out of our hands. We were going to deal with this. You didn't have to even be involved with this. He took him out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come unto thee by examining of whom thyself may take knowledge of all these things, wherefore we accuse him. And all the Jews bobbled their heads, you know, bobbleheads. Yes, 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 these things are so. He's telling the truth. And you'll find out, just like we're accusing him, this is exactly what he did. So, sounds pretty serious. Then Paul, after the governor beckoned him to speak, answered, "For as much as I know that you've been of many years a judge to this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself, because that you may understand that there are yet but 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship." It was 12 days ago that I got to Jerusalem, and half of this time I've been either on the road or here in prison, so I didn't have time to stir any of these things up. He said, "They never found me in the temple disputing with any man, neither raising up the people, neither in the synagogues, nor in the city, nor can they prove anything that they are accusing me of." They can't prove any of it. I'm not guilty, in other words. I am not guilty. But he says, I was in the temple worshiping God. I was paying the vows of my friends, had taken a Nazarite vow. I'm worshiping God lawfully, legally. I didn't cause any problems in the temple. They can't prove any of this. But here's what I will admit. He says, verse 14, "This I confess unto thee, that after the way which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers, believing all things that are written in the law and the prophets." I believe the word of God. "And I have hope towards God, which they themselves also allow, that there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. And herein do I exercise myself to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and towards men. And now after many years, I came to bring alms." I came to bring a gift to my nation. "And offerings, whereupon certain Jews from Asia," that's those Ephesian Jews, "they found me purified in the temple, neither with multitude nor with tumult, causing nobody problems, minding my own business. And if these charges are true," verse 19, "they ought to have been here before thee, and they can raise objections to what I say, if they had anything against me." The very fact that they're absent means they're lying. These charges are a lie. They should have been here. "Or else let these same hear, saying, if they found any evil doing in me while I stood before the council, except it be for this one voice that I cried standing among them, that touching the resurrection of the dead, I'm called in question by you this day." You see, he's also testifying here about the resurrection of Christ, because Christ appeared to him. Christ gave him instructions, what to do, what to say. "When Felix heard these things, having a more perfect knowledge of that way," now that's also what they called the Christians, the way. And he had a knowledge of that way. He'd heard of it before. We don't know where exactly or how, but we do know this. Cornelius, remember Cornelius, Acts chapter 10? He was from Caesarea. And also Philip the evangelist with the four daughters who prophesied. He lived in Caesarea. Maybe he heard the gospel some way through them. His wife was a Jewess. Maybe he heard through her. They were familiar with Christianity because it was growing in that area. So here's what Felix decides, verse 22. "When Felix heard these things, having more perfect knowledge of that way, he deferred them and said, when Lysias, the chief captain, shall come down, I'll know the uttermost of your matter." So rather than dealing with Paul, he's going to defer any judgment. I'm going to call Lysias. Let him come and see if he corroborates your story about how he interrupted your orderly procedure when you took this man out of the temple. In other words, I'm thinking he didn't believe these guys. But I'm gonna call Lysias, and he will come, and he'll set the record straight. And if he corroborates your story, that'll be one thing. In the meantime, he commanded a centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty, and that he should forbid none of his acquaintance to minister or come unto him. Put him back in the guardhouse. And after certain days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, which was a Jewess, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. He just wanted to let Paul talk, just him and his wife, let Paul talk. And when Paul reasoned to them of righteousness and temperance and judgment to come, Felix trembled. So this had to be quite a message Paul delivered. It's got Felix trembling. And he answered, go back to your room for the time being, and when I have a convenient season, I'll call for thee. And here's where the corruption, the politics comes in, because he hoped also that money would have been given him of Paul, that he might loose him, release him. Wherefore he sent for him the oftener and communed with him. Maybe he'll give me money. But after 2 years, Porcius Festus came into Felix's office, his position. And Felix, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, always the politician, left Paul bound. So for two years, Paul remained in that guardhouse. 2 years while Felix kept hoping to get a bribe. By deferring the matter and saying, I'm going to call Lysias to come here and let him tell me what happened, that would make the Jews step back, because they knew they had grossly exaggerated what happened. They painted the wrong picture. Y'all still awake? I'm quitting. So the Jews wanted him to let, the Jews wanted him to put Paul into their hands, let him take him back to Jerusalem, let them deal with him. He wasn't going to do that. And he could have let Paul go, but he wouldn't do that either. Because political reasons, I want to curry the favor of the Jews. But he was already in trouble with the Jews. Several uprisings had happened. He slaughtered a bunch of Jews, and Rome finally got tired of his corruption and everything else, and they recalled him. They pulled him out of there, and they replaced him with Festus, not the guy from Gunsmoke, but it was a different Festus. So look how far we went. Yes, sir. Yes, he took his place. He came and took his office because Rome recalled him and brought him back to Rome. And I heard that he was facing charges, but that's what history says. He was facing charges, but somehow or another they got crushed because, Roman, these guys get away with anything. So Paul is now bound for 2 years, left in a guardhouse. We'll pick up there next time. You see this calling for a more convenient time, I'll call for you. You know how many sermons have been preached from that verse? Because there's a whole lot there. What he says is very convicting, and he's trembling in his boots. So you can say yes, I believe. You can say no, get out, or you can say later. Later. I'll deal with this later. I'm kind of busy right now. And as far as we know, that more convenient time never came. Also, as far as we know, Lysias never came. There's no record of him ever coming. So he probably never really called him. Who knows? Maybe Lysias was gone by that time. He could have been deployed elsewhere. You know, they did that with soldiers. But we'll never know. Anyway, Father, again, thank you for the opportunity to open your word and read, and help us, Lord, to learn, to understand, to comprehend, and, Lord, to apply to our own lives what we learn. Bless your people. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.